we're going to see Donald Trump, and he's going to have some little angels on one shoulder and the devils on the other. And I think it's anybody's bet on any given day which direction he veers off in.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington today, and we're joined here by Rosa Brooks, FP columnist, senior Future of War fellow at New America, professor at Georgetown University, and author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. Also joining us here in D.C. is another FP columnist, Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, where she focuses on military history. And calling in from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Post-election, I'm sure all of you ER nerds have flurries of podcast episode ideas or possibly locations elsewhere in the world from which we can do this podcast. Share your thoughts and ideas by emailing us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Recently, from our tiny podcast studio high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. So I was reflecting on the events of the past week, and I don't want to blow my own horn, but I obviously got this completely correct. I don't know what you're laughing at. First of all, I said Hillary Clinton was the best qualified candidate.
Correct.
I believe she was. Secondly, I said Hillary Clinton would win the election. She won the popular vote. And thirdly, I said the day after the election, a woman would be in charge of the Atlantic Alliance for the first time. And indeed, the day after the election, Angela Merkel is now in charge of the Atlantic Alliance. So I say that as 100%. Corey, there you are, professor. How am I doing?
You know, the Roman general Pyrrhus, after a great battlefield victory.
One of these days, Corey's going to go, there is a cave painting in Let's Go, France.
There is, in fact, a cave painting that depicts Donald Trump. It was foretold by the Neanderthals.
Let me just say.
From whom he is directly descended. Exactly.
David has just given us the textbook description of a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah, that is a Pyrrhic victory. It does, however, raise the question of what's this world going to be like post-Trump? And, you know, pieces are sort of slowly falling into place. And I'd like to talk a little bit about how the pieces are falling into place inside Washington. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about how they're falling into place outside of Washington. Inside of Washington, on the national security and foreign policy front, publications like the New York Times, remember that one, David?
I do. They send me a paycheck on rare occasions.
On rare occasions. Well, there you go. That's loyalty for you. But in any event, they'll run lists. You know, everybody's running lists. And, they're, here are the people who will have jobs in the cabinet. And I look at the lists and I think, oh, not all of these people are crazy. Some of these people have experience. Some of these people are the people that we thought he was not going to turn to. So maybe things will be okay. And then on the other hand, he actually makes appointments. And in his first two appointments, he picked as White House Chief of Staff Rance Priebus, who has no government experience, which is a problem because Trump has no government experience. And so that's a bit of an issue. But clearly, he was a political sop to the establishment. And then in the same breath, he picked Steve Bannon for chief strategist and a senior counselor, which is essentially the Valerie Jarrett job, the person behind the curtain job that's pulling the levers and is super important. And Steve Bannon is horrible. He's like as bad as it gets. He's the godfather of the alt-right movement. His publication, Breitbart, hates women. It hates Muslims. It hates blacks. It hates Jews.
In short, he's in perfect tune with the president.
Well, that's the issue. That's the issue, you know. We've got one group that said, oh, well, Mike Pence and Paul Ryan and all these people, they'll moderate this guy. And then on the other hand, with his very first pick, he seems to say, nah, I really want to go with the guys that I like, you know. And he goes for, like, one of them, possibly, and you guys are very experienced. Corey's knowledge of this goes back to the Emperor
Augustus.
The Roman
General Pyrrhus.
Right?
Exactly.
Mine goes back to the Neanderthals.
Yeah, and you go back to the Neanderthals. I think it may be that Steve Bannon is the most odious person ever appointed to a senior White House job. Does anybody differ on that?
I do not.
Mr. Sanger?
You know, I'm trying to think back to when you covered Colonel House, David, back in the Woodrow Wilson administration. But from everything I've read about Mr. Bannon, I think he probably would take that title.
I mean, it's amazing. You know, it's just amazing. You know, here's a guy who was accused of beating his wife. His wife in sworn testimony said he was an anti-Semite. Has run a company where there is a giant paper trail or electron trail of all the horrible things they've written by all these horrible people. On top of all of that, if that wasn't, you know, an affront to your sensibilities and you were actually a Trump supporter, he's a former Goldman Sachs banker. It's like these are the people we're supposed to be draining out of the swamp. And he looks like a pervert. I mean, he looks like... You know, he looks like he should be wearing a raincoat with nothing on.
Can you say a little bit more about what perverts look like?
Well, they look like Steve Bannon. I mean, obviously, if you see somebody coming at you.
Yeah, you're right. No,
and it looks like Steve Bannon and he's wearing a trench coat, you cross the street, right? So, you know, what's up? Who's the true Trump, Rosa?
I don't think there is a true Trump except a guy who's all id and likes people to agree with him and likes people who give the middle finger to people who don't agree with him. I mean, my husband, the optimist, said, well, maybe now Trump is going to stun his gullible supporters by reverting back to being a New York liberal. And I thought, well, that's certainly very optimistic. But who knows, right? I mean, Trump, there are very few positions that Donald Trump has not over the years taken at one point or another, including one in direct contradiction to each other. So I don't think shouldn't be a surprise to us that we are beginning to see some contradictory patterns emerge even in his early staffing decisions. I think we're going to continue to see that. And I think that, you know, my prediction for the next 4 years is that we will continue to see a war between the better angels of the Republican Party and Donald Trump versus the worse angels. You ever read all the Hergé Tintin books? I say Tintin. The French say Tintin. But I can't say that. Yeah. So I just say Tintin. You know, remember Captain Haddock?
Yeah.
And Captain Haddock, who's a heavy drinker, whenever he's thinking about taking a drink, he's got a little angel haddock on one shoulder and a devil haddock on the other shoulder. And the angel haddock is saying, oh, no, haddock, don't drink that. And the devil haddock is saying, go ahead. And I think that's what it's we're going to see Donald Trump. And he's going to have some little angels on one shoulder and the devils on the other. And I think it's anybody's bet on any given day which direction he veers off in.
Corey was going to point out that Hergé and those Tintin books are also incredibly racist.
I know.
Okay.
The dog is cute, damn it. And Snowy. So is Captain Haddock.
Snowy is. Anyway. And the Thompson twins were in that, and then they created a group called the Thompson twins.
Except they shaved their mustaches and they made an 80s Europop band.
The vacuous expression on my face that listeners cannot capture is about to be filled by David pointing out the lack of my contemporary cultural knowledge.
Thompson twins.
All I can say is if you consider Tintin contemporary cultural knowledge, that explains the whole problem because you haven't even gotten to like the mid-50s yet. But in any event, just to go to this question before we get to David, Corey, you know, who in your view is the true Trump? What have you learned in the past week?
I don't know the answer to that question, to be honest. What it looks to me is that I think we should take him at his word, and his words have been genuinely disrespectful, dangerous, and reckless. And so that's how I would bet my money on this. And if he is genuinely creating a system in which people like Bannon have jobs that are symbolic and people who know how to run the government have the functional jobs, that may be a good outcome, but it's a good outcome within the context of the fact that the President of the United States himself and Steve Bannon, his counselor, are going to continue to say and do things that are deeply dangerous and destabilizing both to the American body politic and to America's role in the world.
David, alone among the four of us, you have spent quality time with Donald Trump. in fine hotel rooms or wherever it was that you spent the quality time with him. What's your view on this?
My view is that you have a group of people who are grappling for the soul of a president who doesn't really have very many views right now on the issues that listeners to the ER are most concerned about. He's said many things, but they have mostly been at the slogan level, America first, we're going to make America great again. But if you tried to dig deeper and ask the question, what does he mean by that? You could find quotes that would support any of a number of different positions. Let me give you just one example. He's made the case that we need to be pulling out of the Middle East, that we've spent too much money, too much blood there. On the other hand, he has said that we need to bomb the shit out of ISIS and that we need to take their oil. And the way I read Rose's book and Corey's many books, although I can never keep up with how many books Corey has published at any given time, I would say that if you were going to take the oil, you need to have people on the ground. Just on Friday, he told the Wall Street Journal that he would reverse the support of the rebels who are going after Assad, suggesting that he would basically shift the United States to lining up with Assad, the Russians, and while he didn't say it, I think the Iranians are on that same side, too. So I just don't think he knows yet.
So in my never-ending efforts to find a silver lining in our time of national catastrophe, I do think the fact that he doesn't appear to have an ideology underpinning his views could be positive. He could make pragmatic choices. He could do what President Obama did once he was elected in 2008 and recant as President Obama recanted his opposition to free trade. He recanted his opposition to several of the counterterrorism policies of the Bush administration. Maybe since Donald Trump has a clean slate, as every new American president does, maybe he will make sensible, pragmatic choices. But I would not bet any of my own money that way.
Well, let's talk about some of the names that we've seen now for some of these lists. Some of them sound sensible, but aren't. You know, Mike Flynn was a general who ran the Defense Intelligence Agency. Is that a sensible choice?
So I have a couple of reactions to that. The first is that I think it matters on what job people go to, right? It's the matching of people's personal skills to their responsibilities. But second, I view Mike Flynn's story as an actual tragedy, because what I thought I saw as watching his career was someone who tried hard to wrench an intelligence agency into being more operationally valuable to the wars we were fighting. And in the course of that, made a lot of enemies of people who thought the status quo was working pretty well. And while paying such careful attention to intelligence, became deeply and profoundly upset by the fact that President Obama was claiming that the threat was diminishing, and in his judgment, it hadn't. And that's the point at which this becomes a tragedy, because I think he is slightly unhinged since then. And a lot of the things he did during the course of the campaign are actually quite damaging to American civil-military relations. And I think the intemperateness of his judgments on how to manage the problems he's rightly drawing attention to, I think show his inexperience in trying to craft government policy, to use a variety of tools to improve a set of circumstances, which is the point of strategy. So I'm deeply skeptical that somebody could, for example, be a good national security advisor who hadn't worked in the interagency trying to pull the pieces of the American government together.
Yeah, it's interesting also coming from a guy who made sort of as a campaign platform that he doesn't trust the generals and he doesn't trust the intelligence community. Some of the generals who have signed on to him are absolutely crackpots. I mean, the most deranged sorts of generals that there are, many of whom, you know, stopped at one star, two stars for a reason. You know, that they just weren't able to continue up the food chain. But Rosa, you know, you said your husband was an optimist. Perhaps you have an optimistic streak within you. Is there somebody in the national security realm who's currently being mentioned for Trump that you think might be a good candidate, you know?
Well, we were talking right before we began to record this, and obviously one of the names that comes up when people talk about this is the New York Times said his name as well as Steve Hadley, who was the national security advisor during the second George W. Bush administration, and I think is widely viewed by both Democrats and Republicans alike as a non-ideological, very competent guy.
Hear, hear.
So that's the one name that I think who knows whether, in fact, the Trump inner circle is seriously looking at him or whether that's just another liberal fantasy. But I think that would be a choice either at the NSC or in another important cabinet position that would certainly make people feel a little bit calmer that there's a grown-up in charge. And one of the things, obviously, and David, both you and Corey are more expert on this than I am, that, you know, people really credit Hadley with helping to reverse some of the excesses of the first Bush administration and to get things back on a sane track. So that's the only name that I think is reassuring at this point.
Well, you know, Corey worked for Steve, so she can do a much better description, but a few things about Hadley that I think would be notable if they pick him. First, he has deep experience in the control of nuclear weapons. And since, let's face it, that's one of our big concerns about this administration, I think that having Hadley there would relieve a lot of those concerns. Secondly, he was a major author of President Obama's second inaugural address, which said that the goal of the United States would be to spread democracy around the world. Now, he wasn't the only author. Condoleezza Rice and others.
By Obama, I think you mean Bush.
I'm sorry, by President Bush.
it's all blurring together.
And
lucky Sanger can even remember them at this point.
That's true. That's true at my advanced age. So this was the address that he gave in 2005, January 2005. And it was Hadley who went out to explain why this made sense as a national mission for the U.S. Well, it is completely opposite the national mission that you've heard from Donald Trump. And Hadley represents the Republican establishment. So I think if he chose Hadley, it would probably outrage a section of his supporters, but it would indicate to you that you were getting a much more traditional foreign policy.
Well, but wait a second.
Let's not jump.
Right. Let's not jump to conclusions here. Hadley would be a sign of that. He's as establishment as they go. And I, just like everybody else, you know, sort of join in the embrace of the idea of Steve Hadley. My last book, Steve Hadley was the hero of my last book. He was really somebody who I think has done the job of national security advisor virtually as well as anybody else who's ever done it. He's got the right temperament, the right background. He's perfect. However, the national security establishment of the United States is a personality cocktail. It is not driven by any one individual, if we exclude from that the president. The president is the dominant character and has the ability to empower or disempower people day in, day out, constantly, just based on their moods. So at the center of this, we have the mercurial Trump. Furthermore, very often back, you know, sort of behind closed doors, meddling with the good work of policymakers or political people. And we know that we've now got back behind the scenes Steve Bannon, who's evil. And then we also know we have Rance Priebus, who would sort of do anything, you know, go along with anything, not raise an eyebrow when his candidate is a racist or an Islamophobe or anything else. So that's a little bit troubling. But then you've got the other names. And the other names in the national security space include Flynn, include people like John Bolton, former U.N. ambassador as a potential secretary of state, or
Stanley
Richard—
Stanley McChrystal's name was in the Times this morning as another secretary of state possibility, and I wondered
kind
where
of
that came from.
Well, somebody threw that out there to have another sort of moderate in there. He would be probably good for something. Richard Grinnell was, you know, who was Bolton's spokesperson at the UN, was mentioned as a potential UN ambassador who is, I mean, you know, read his stuff. I'm not going to judge it, but I wouldn't say he's in the comforting category of people that fall into this. Senator Jeff Sessions is somebody who's on the list, who is, you know, to the right of Attila the Hun. On the Homeland Security front, which is not unimportant, one of the people on the top of the list is Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Arizona, who, you know, is like, I don't know whether he's under indictment or lawsuit or something for being just awful. You know, I mean, in his dealing with immigrants, it's always the cocktail, you know. You can put in a name like, you know, Rance Priebus or Steve Hadley and say, oh, well, everything's going to be fine. Look, there's a sane person here. But it's how the chemicals work, right, Corey?
Yes. So David is exactly right on this. And the person who would even more enthusiastically endorse David's judgment on this, even more so than I do, is Steve Hadley himself, right? When Will Wexler and I were doing this look at interagency reform, Steve Hadley gave us an outstanding interview in which he said, presidents get the national security teams they deserve. It's a team sport. You have to pick each individual player with an eye to how they are going to work together. And it was Steve Hadley who engineered getting Donald Rumsfeld out of the Bush administration so that the second Bush term could actually congeal together as a team. So I think he would have a rich appreciation that one very good cabinet secretary can't save you from a president who doesn't think seriously about how do we make policy well.
Do you think the president's lack of experience in foreign policy and national security policy, you know, might be a detriment?
Possibly, David.
you should remember here that Steve Hadley actually has experience dealing with a president whose background in national security was, say, a little bit wanting. I mean, he was part of the education team of George Bush. And I remember Bush teasing him greatly when he showed up at the cafe in Crawford, Texas, the only one where we could all go get a cup of coffee with Bush, but he was wearing his Yale windbreaker. You don't wear many of those, it turns out, in Crawford, Texas. But he took it gamely and actually ended up, I think, being one of the most influential people over the president by the second term. And makes this interesting.
There, as a sometime editor, is the lead that just got buried in what you're saying, which is the second term. And having George W. Bush's first term would be characterized by no one, including anyone in the Bush administration, as a great foreign policy success. His second term, when the president had learned, as well as Hadley and the other members of the team, I mean, you know, other good things happened. Condoleezza Rice, who in my view, and I know this is not hyper-popular perspective within the Democratic foreign policy community, is actually extremely competent, thoughtful, capable woman, was much better suited to be Secretary of State than she was to be National Security Advisor. And she had a relationship with Hadley. And both of them had a relationship with the president. And in the second term, they had a president who had 4 years of experience and had gotten rid of Donald Rumsfeld and had sidelined to a greater extent Dick Cheney. And all of a sudden, there was a certain kind of organic balance that had been restored to this NSC, which then for the last 2 or 3 years operated at a very high level and was probably the most successful NSC since George H.W. Bush. So, you know, it is, again, true that it would help to have people like this. Are there any other names? I'm grasping at straws here. That if our, you know, listeners are reading the paper and they see this name getting an important job, you think, whew, what a relief.
I'm not seeing specific names. What I'm seeing, and I'm curious to know whether this is true, are articles suggesting that the Trump campaign and transition staff are at least reaching out to many of the people who, like Corey, are Republican national security experts who signed various letters saying, I oppose Trump and I wouldn't work for him. I hope that that's true because I would feel very comforted if many of those people who signed those letters were in the administration. I would feel slightly better ever so
slightly.
Do we see much evidence that's happening? That's
right
what
now?
I'm wondering because I've seen speculation and I have seen a few references, including David in the Times in articles saying that sources suggest that the transition team is reaching out and hasn't actually.
Well, I would draw a line between reaching out and thinking about.
Yeah, so I don't know.
Corbin, you'll be a good test. You signed everything there was to sign here. Have they been begging you to come in?
They have not, but I've also been quite clear about the fact that never means never.
Well, Corey is one of the unusual Washington policy people who's actually burdened with principles. Many other people find that their principles are born on a foundation of self-interest.
Well, here's a
which allows them to shift a bit.
Let me throw out a question to the three of you. So, one hypothesis, one very optimistic at the moment hypothesis about Donald Trump and sort of radical course changes. Is that the federal bureaucracy itself will be an important break on craziness. That, yeah, we all get frustrated when the bureaucratic processes put the brakes on good innovation, but, many would say that this is a feature, not a bug, of the system, that a slow, annoying, molasses-like process is actually a good thing because every 4 years you get a president who comes in and we build everything on the assumption that you might get crazy people coming in with crazy ideas. Do we think this is true?
I do think it will be a shock for President Trump how difficult it is to get anything done. And that is partly because of the bureaucracy. It's also partly because the system's designed to work on consensus. And so all of the fail-safes that are built in, leaks to the press, testimony to Congress, active duty military folks resigning their commissions if they are given illegal orders of the kind candidate Trump tossed off so easily, all of those things will slow anything happening. And unless Trump can actually build a consensus, I think the greatest likelihood is that this will be 4 years in which very little gets accomplished. But I would put one big caveat on that, which is that I think the most interesting question politically now is whether Republicans in Congress have a policy agenda that they can navigate with, or whether the Republican Party simply becomes Donald Trump's party.
Well, I think that there's a lot of people in the Republican establishment who think, okay, he doesn't really understand how this works. We are going to get involved and we are going to constrain it a little bit. Paul Ryan says, well, look, I'm not going along with everything. And Mitch McConnell says, I'm not going along with everything. And, and so there is this sense, and there are people in the bureaucracy who feel that they may be stabilizers in that regard as well. Having said that, they're all a little wary that maybe Trump understands the politics of the moment better than they do. And it's not clear, my girlfriend has a particular interest in dogs, and she sometimes talks about going to the dog park and watching people and wondering whether the dog is walking the owner or the owner is walking the dog. And I think that this is something that we, may look at with Trump and the Republican establishment. I think the Republican establishment feels they're going to be able to control him, and he believes he's going to be able to control them. I'm more worried that this is also true with Trump and his supporters in the United States.
Interesting point.
Because, these people have been responsible for hundreds of hate incidents during the course of the week since the election, during which period Trump did not respond until very, very late on a 60 Minutes episode in a half-hearted way to all of that in any way except to appoint the leader of the hate movement as his chief strategy advisor. And these people are going to get empowered. And at a certain point, after maybe Trump appoints a Wall Street Treasury secretary, and a bunch of corporate hoo-has to high positions in his whole thing, and starts cutting taxes for the rich and not doing much for the poor. And they're going to start going, WTF, folks, you know, what's going on here? And they're going to start pulling in another direction. And, you know, I think this is one of those cases where, as we have seen in the past in history, you could end up with a empowered, mobilized, not terribly rational, large segment of the populace starting to be the dog that walks the person who's supposed to be in charge, as opposed to the other way around. David, does that worry you?
Well, it certainly worries my dog, who's a very friendly Labrador retriever, and is quite persuaded that she walks us, not the other way around. Look,
I've met this dog, and I'm persuaded of that as well.
You know, sometime we'll have her on the ER, and I think you'll discover that she's better than at least one of your panelists.
Hey,
that would be me. Okay. So, and she'd tell you that. No, I think this is not the first time. And, you know, you had this argument during the Bush administration. How many cocktail parties did you go to in New York in particular where people said Cheney is the president? Well, what people missed was that while Cheney may have been highly influential for the first two or three years, at some point, George W. Bush decided that he no longer trusted the advice he was getting from Cheney. It may have come after Iraq didn't turn out quite as advertised. And Cheney began to get frozen out, and Bush took over his own administration. So it's not necessarily true that how this starts is how this ends.
That's true. But, you know, Bush also, to his credit, may have been a screw-up for part of his life and may not have been the world's best student and may not have started out as the world's best president. But he did come from a family with certain kinds of values. And he was, at his core, a certain kind of person. And as he grew into the job, those things manifested themselves in an enlightened immigration policy, an enlightened policy with regard to AIDS in Africa, an enlightened policy with regard to emerging markets, compared to current group of Republicans, much more enlightened views on things like renewable energy and other kinds of things. There's a lot of fundamental decency in George Bush, even if we disagree about some of his policies. So far to date, I haven't seen a lot of evidence of the fundamental decency in Donald Trump.
David, the one place where I would quibble with your characterization of Trump supporters is, while I think there are unquestionably racist, xenophobic, sexist bigots among Trump supporters, I don't I don't think that by any stretch the majority of the people who voted for Trump share those sentiments. I think that
I second that.
They're there, but they're not universal. And I think that, you know, the Trump supporters include a lot of just desperate people and angry people who also voted for Obama, you know, and who in a different, slightly different universe will vote for an Obama again, you know. And I do think, though, that being said, I was watching, you know, something on one of the cable channels, a very sort of poignant interview with some Trump voters who sort of said, well, our factory is slated to close in 2019 and go to Bangladesh or wherever. And I'm so happy that Donald Trump won because now we're going to keep our jobs. And I thought, you poor sucker, you know, and those, you know, I think that the people who voted for Trump because they thought he was good for their pocketbook and he was magically going to be, you know, restoring America's industrial base, you know, by waving a wand, are doomed to be disappointed. And as you suggest, I think they're doomed to end up very angry at Trump himself, you know, when they start seeing the Goldman Sachs guys and the same old. Will he be able to control that? Doubtful. And will that group shift right back to the Democrat, whoever that is, the next time around? Totally possible.
Well, look. In Washington and in the U.S. body politic, by far the most powerful force is inertia. And we saw that in this last election, where most people didn't vote, right. Where fewer people voted than in the past, where Trump actually won with less votes than Hillary, and Hillary got less votes than Romney got in the last round of the election. And that inertia is troublesome with regard to your point, Rosa, because most of these people may just have wanted a change. But in order to get that change, they were willing to accept racism, homophobia, Islamophobia, misogyny, corrupt behavior, repulsive interpersonal behavior. And that suggests they would be willing to accept that again. And, you know, when inertia is the principal force, then those who assume an activist role can lead. And often it's extremists who assume the activist role. And in this particular case, there are a wide variety of extremist groups who are more empowered today than they have ever been. And so I am optimistic, and I share your view about the fundamental goodness of most Americans. But I also share a view that many of those Americans who voted for Trump were willing to accept things that they shouldn't have been willing to accept and may do so again. Corey, you're nodding.
Yeah, I think that's right. The arc of history doesn't bend towards justice. The arc of history bends towards whoever grabs onto it and yanks it the direction they're going. And I think the fact that 46% of people didn't vote in this election means one of several possible things. Either people don't want change as much as they say they want, or they don't have confidence the system can produce change. And if it's that latter, I do think if Trump disappoints them, it will further aggravate this belief that our government's incapable of solving problems, and therefore we need more radical change.
Before I turn to you, David, I do want to make a plea there. If you voted for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, please stop listening to this podcast. We don't get paid by the listener. You are an idiot. You screwed up the election. You wasted your vote. You did huge damage to the future of the United States. And if you think, oh, well, I was a protest vote, when we start deporting some of those 3 million people, many of whom are not going to deserve to be deported, many of whom are going to have families, but who will literally be taken from their homes and sent to another country, when we start pushing back on the rights of women, or we start pushing back on the rights of Muslims, and we stop accepting refugees, and we stop behaving in a humanitarian way, and you say, how did we get here? The answer is you. You made this difference. Now, you're not the only ones who made this difference, but you made a special choice, and I really hope you enjoy listening to someone else's podcast. David, among the constraints on among the constraints.
We're in stunned silence over here.
Yeah. But among the constraints on the incoming president, we're going to just sort of tee this up here, and then we're going to follow this in the next episode, are the rest of the world. And I was kind of interested in the reaction of the rest of the world. Putin, you know, dragged himself out of bed after a big hangover celebrating the Trump victory. He can't believe how lucky he's gotten. Sent a note that Trump talked about as though it were a love letter from Keats or something. You know, it was beautiful and effusive and so on and so forth. Bashar al-Assad, another guy you want to have on your team, is like, oh, yeah, this is a guy we can work with. Theresa May, who is, both a sort of right-wing nationalist and a xenophobe and a lot of the things that you don't want to see in a leader, said, great. The Le Pen clan in France, who, you know, have a good chance of taking over that country in the next round of elections, given Hollande's 4% approval rating, which is, you know, half that of the U.S. Congress, to put it in perspective, reached out to Trump. And Steve Bannon, that angel who's leading America now, wrote back and said, oh, yeah, we'd love to work with you, you neo-Nazis. He didn't say that, nor do I think he would have considered it the insult that I consider it. Meanwhile, people like Angela Merkel and Nicola Sturgeon and some others said, look, I'm happy to work with Trump if he sticks with our values, sending a message that you know, we don't follow automatically, and we are here to influence as equals. David, what did you pick up in the international reaction that you think we ought to pay attention to?
Boy, there was a question in there someplace. So here are a few things. First of all, while we have been on having this delightful conversation, Donald Trump's been busy being on the phone with Vladimir Putin just this afternoon.
That's sweet.
So, isn't that nice? And
Vlad, I've written you a haiku.
The first of many interesting conversations, and I think one of the most interesting is whether or not you are already going to see, even before Obama is out of office, an effort by Putin to begin to change the nature of the relationship by cutting some deals, whether it's on Syria or Ukraine or the future of sanctions, American and European sanctions, with Donald Trump, so that on day one, they make some big announcements. And I would not consider it unlikely that that would happen.
Your favorite international reactions?
I think the German chancellor made a mistake by being so public about the conditionality of her support. And I'm sympathetic to the reason that she did it, but it seems to me a poor way to begin a relationship that's going to be fraught in any event. And I think it unlikely to help her have the influence she would like to have over his choices.
Possibly. I'll give you the counterargument, which is she lives on a continent where the right is going unchecked in a lot of places. And I don't mean the right in the sense of, you know, sort of Reagan, Thatcher conservatives. I mean the right in the sense of this kind of xenophobic nationalist extreme right in almost every country around her. And I think part of what she has to do to maintain her political footing is to be public and say, I'm on a different course, possibly. That's just an interpretation. Rosa.
Yeah, I actually wanted to make a different point, which going back to sort of what when we say things like, well, obviously Trump had a better read on the politics of our time than, you know, the New York Times did and so forth. I want to caution us all against shifting from thinking of Trump as this buffoon to thinking of him as a buffoon who somehow is magic, who gets whatever he wants and who you know, can see the political winds blowing that we clueless, you know, liberals in our bubble or elites in our bubble somehow miss. You know, Donald Trump's track record remains a bad track record. He does not have a track record of successes in his business dealings. You know, he has a track record of disasters and near disasters. And there's no particular reason to think that suddenly he's found this incredible sort of inner ability to channel the popular will and get things done, blindsiding everybody else going into the next 4 years. I don't know whether this is seeing a silver lining or just in fact seeing an even darker storm cloud. But I think that his track record of incompetence is there's every likelihood that that will in fact continue, and that the things that he sets out to do, he won't accomplish particularly effectively, not so much because of external opposition, but because he's going to do them in a stupid way. So is this good or bad? I have no idea. But I do think the sort of the reaction in the mainstream media and in many of the circles that we frequent to Trump is almost this sort of humiliated sense of, oh, God, obviously we know nothing and Donald Trump has this sort of amazing magic touch. He still doesn't.
I think that's a really important point. And we're at, you know, the end of this particular episode, and I want to get more into the global situation next week and talk about some of these legacy issues that Obama has that may be undone, right? Whether it's the Iran deal
or worse, the legacies that Obama has created in terms of executive power that Trump is going to happily pick up and extend.
Exactly, and I think that's those are really important points, and I don't want to leave a cliffhanger here, but this is a conversation that is going to go on. And frankly, you know, my admonition to anybody who's listening is, keep listening, not just to us. Listen to
what's
going on.
Unless you voted for third-party candidate.
Those other people we're done with. But speak to him. But the rest of them,
David.
Yeah.
One quick thing about listening. One of the things that I've just noticed over the past few days since the election is that there's already a significant backlash among Trump supporters against people who do what all of us are tempted to go do here, which is to go examine what he said during the campaign and then compare it to what he's doing. Now, they view this as a big game and trap intended to say, see, he's a hypocrite and so forth. But it's an interesting example of the reality issues we're all going to have to go deal with, because
absolutely is, and I think, you know, this is a hodgepodge of things, and people who say it was cynical politics or people who say it was canny politics have some proof to it, have some justification, and people who say Hillary blew it, and people who say that Putin had his thumb on the scale or that Comey screwed it up or whatever, all of these things have some truth to them. But I think Rosa put her finger on, you know, a core truth, because this is the Trump era. And we have to look at somebody whose behavior has ranged from the unsuccessful and crass to the really pernicious and evil. And we have to listen to what's going on, but we also have to not normalize what's abnormal. We have to not accept hatred, intolerance, the abrogation of international responsibilities, creating new kinds of risks at home, stopping to care about people just because, well, he was elected. And I do think the other thing is we don't want to attribute too much genius to Donald Trump, who lost the popular vote by over 1 million votes, who barely won the electoral vote in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan by tens of thousands of votes, who expected to lose, who by all rights, had the voters been a little bit more engaged, would have lost, and who represents, by any definition, 25% of the American electorate, because half didn't vote and the other half voted for Hillary Clinton. So this remains a minority government speaking for a minority of the people. So, you know, he won by our rules, but he has yet to prove himself to be a genius in my book. And I think we need to watch that, hope for the best because it's good for us, but prepare for the worst because experience and his track record suggest that may be what comes. And on that cheerful ending, David Sanger and your dog, thank you very much. sounds just like your dog.
My dog would be honored to know that she has been featured on the ER.
Yeah, well, we'll make sure that she's featured in all the ads. Rosa, who did such an excellent impression of David's dog, thank you very much. And Corey, thank you for refraining from doing an impression of David's dog.
We can now howl all together like wolves. Though. That would be a good way to end this episode.
We could howl at the moon. Yeah. And we'll come back next week and we'll talk about the rest of the world and this. And then maybe someday we'll get over this and get back onto some other issue, God willing. Thank you all. See you next week.